This is Stateside.
I'm April Baer. Today, what the executive orders on deportation will mean in Michigan.
At stake is sort of like their livelihood, ability to make plans for themselves, or just to have some peace of mind that things won't change all of a sudden, just as if they've done the last 4 years.
Also, ready for some reads? The annual list of Michigan notable books might give you a new lens to view strange times.
Yeah, I just didn't want to put this book down. I didn't want it to stop. I wanted more essays. I found it to be just a very, very, very beautiful book.
And we'll speak with one of the authors on the list, Alice Randall. Her story collection conjures the Black Bottom Saints of Detroit's storied business district.
The published record doesn't always well and truthfully document underprivileged people.
We've got those conversations and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. If the opening weeks of 2021 have you ready to dive under a blanket with a book for the rest of the month, we have a show for you today. The annual list of Michigan notable books has achieved a remarkable thing, finding some reads that speak to the weird, sometimes frightening, and occasionally amazing things going on right now.
Yeah, I just didn't want to put this book down. I didn't want it to stop. I wanted more essays. And I found it to be just a very, very, very beautiful book overall, just exploring the nature of our state.
We're going to talk about some of the books on the list in just a few minutes, but first, the executive orders that President Biden has already signed include some major shifts away from Trump-era policies. That includes a halt to deportations for most people. The Trump administration's deportation rules made anyone who came to the United States without going through a specific set of legal hoops vulnerable to deportation, including adults who came here as children and who've lived here most of their lives. In Michigan, that put a couple of specific groups of people on edge, including Arabs, Chaldeans, and Latinos. Here to tell us how some in the Latino community are receiving the news about Biden's reversal of deportation rules is Maria Ibarra. She's an advocate with We the People Michigan. Maria, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
So much has happened in the past 24 hours. What was your reaction when you heard that President Biden suspended deportations?
I was excited, a little bit surprised, actually, to be honest. I didn't expect him to do that or to follow through, especially because he hadn't really talked about that during his campaign. And I'm also cautious. I've seen a lot of immigration-related promises. So I'm cautious, and I have a lot of questions about what's going to happen, primarily to people right now who are detained, who are in immigration detention, people who've been detained for a very, very long time, and would want to see if they're going to be released, because they're every day they're facing particularly a very strong threat of COVID. So I have a lot of questions as well.
What is your sense of the pace of deportations over the past 6 months or so?
You know, it's kind of wild. For some people, it's really, really fast. It's faster than they're ready. You know, no one's ever ready for deportation. But for some people, it's they get detained for something as simple as being pulled over for a routine traffic stop. And then within a few weeks, they're deported. But then for other people, particularly people who are from countries other than like the traditional places like Mexico, or people who want to fight their case, it's been longer. So I've worked with folks who've been in detention for years. Talking with some folks last year who've been in detention for probably somewhere between 6 to 12 months. And these were folks who had complicated immigration cases, people who were here looking for asylum, people who screen cards had been expired and they weren't able to renew it. So their case was much more complicated and they wanted to stay and fight it. And they'd been in detention for many as long as like over a year.
I was curious about how COVID might be affecting the pace of this work, both for people who are pressing for deportation and people who are fighting it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's made it much more difficult. I remember we had a couple cases of people who, honestly, they were trying to be deported. This is like it's so heartbreaking that it has come to this point where people would rather be sent back to their home countries where they face imminent threat than to be locked up in a cage and risk being exposed to COVID, and then also not having the adequate care. Because we all know, and we know that detention centers, jails, prisons are no place for healthcare. They don't have those resources. It's made it really complicated and really confusing, honestly, to sometimes feel like the thing that we're fighting for is a speedier deportation, because that's the best case scenario for that person.
We know that DHS is now reviewing some of the related policies to see what should stay and what should go. What would you like to see get some attention right now?
Definitely the asylum policies and how people are treated when they seek asylum in the U.S. I know that that's part of the memo that Biden's endowed a review of what this looks like in ending the stay in Mexico mandate. I would want to see some very strong effort to try to repair the harm that happened to all those families and children that were separated at the border over the past 3-4 years. To try to see what family reunifications can be made. And, you know, this is what I think about all the time. I'm sure that people would have pushed back against this, but I really think there should be some kind of compensation to those families for the emotional and psychological trauma that has caused them. And also, you know, there's part of Biden's plans is a proposal for immigration reform at a national level, which I think would be amazing and incredible, but I'm very cautious and I'm not allowing myself to get excited until something is actually signed into law and also enacted, because as we've seen, just because something is law doesn't mean it's actually going to happen until people that I love, my community, my family, my loved ones are actually being able to adjust their status.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty notable that Biden is proposing this pathway to citizenship at this moment. That's something that's been hanging out there for years and years and years with no action. We know that Biden's plan proposes an 8-year path that's relatively short compared with some other proposals that have been under discussion over time. What do you think would be important to making that pathway a realistic step for people to take?
I think it needs to address all the different kinds of ways that people came into the U.S. and how long they've been here. I would hate for that plan to have some kind of caveat about, like, if you came in a particular way or if you only been here a particular amount of time that you're not eligible. Because we can't have these kind of piecemeal plans that only address and only provide solutions for certain people. You know, we see that with DACA, that it was great for undocumented young people that were here within a certain time frame, but there's this whole new generation of young people who are undocumented and don't qualify, and it just keeps causing the same problems over and over. So if it's actually going to be comprehensive, how do we look at the around 11 million people here who are undocumented and right now have no actual legal pathway? There's no line you can get into. There's no application that you can fill out to become a citizen, and creating some kind of system that works for everyone that is also affordable. That's the big thing. Immigration processes are incredibly expensive, like thousands and thousands of dollars, not to mention the fees for a lawyer, which is also, you know, a process like this could easily look around like $5,000 per person. Mm-hmm. It has to be affordable for people, especially right now. Otherwise, it's not going to be anything.
Yeah. The last time we talked to you, the question on the table was just the future for DACA recipients. Now, a freeze on deportations, talk of a pathway to citizenship. What are the stakes for all the folks who might be affected by these decisions?
It's a lot of, still a lot of uncertainty. Just, you know, this is a halt for 100 days. 100 days is 3 months. It's going to be, you know, you can easily spend that much time in detention and nothing really happens to your case. So there is still a lot of uncertainty. I think most of the people that I know who are undocumented, who are going through this every day, have been very cautious and are kind of just like, okay, we'll see. They've heard these promises for the last, I've been doing this work for over 10 years. And I know that the first time I ever heard about the Dream Act was like around 2001. So people have been hearing these kinds of things for the past 20 years. I think at stake is sort of like their livelihood, their ability to make plans for themselves, or just to have some peace of mind that things won't change all of a sudden, just as if they've done for the last 4 years, that something is proposed and all of a sudden there's all these barriers that get put up by the administration or by the Supreme Court or by the Senate. So folks, we'll need some time to actually see whether or not these things come through.
Yeah, I imagine it's got to be very difficult to even just, you know, manage one's expectations in that situation. These are normally life decisions that have huge effects on people's lives. You know, they affect family structure and marriage and kids' relationships with their parents and so many other things. But to turn them into these long-running procedural and bureaucratic affairs, I wonder what effect that has on people's emotions and relationships long-term.
Mm-hmm. It's hard. It's really hard to not know exactly how to plan your life, what's going to happen. So, speaking to DACA, as myself as a DACA recipient, there's been, at this point I've lost track of how many times DACA was in danger and then it wasn't and then it was. It's really hard to feel like you can make a plan for yourself. I know a lot of folks who like were worried about whether or not they could have a job where they were going to feel like they were safe. It's very emotionally difficult to live with so much uncertainty, especially when you add the added layer of, it's really difficult to live in a world of COVID right now where there's so much uncertainty. So adding this extra level of like, okay, am I going to be able to stay here in this country long term? Or the U.S. government has all the information they need to know about me. Are they going to use that potentially to remove everybody? So it's a sort of an emotional roller coaster. And it's really hard to know exactly what to do when your life plans are changing every 6 months.
Maria Ibarra with We the People Michigan. Maria, thank you so much for talking with us again.
Thank you.
We so appreciate having you tune in for Stateside every day. But we'd love to actually hear from you, too. Let us know what's going on in your corner of the state and maybe some stories that we might be missing. You can also connect with other listeners and Stateside staff about the show. There are a couple of places to find us. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Also, you can find us on Facebook on the Michigan Radio page or send us an email. Our address is stateside@michiganradio.org. Coming up, from a Mormon king to the saints of Detroit's Black Bottom neighborhood, this year's Michigan Notable Books have something for everyone. We'll hear what's on the list in a moment. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Is there a book for every problem that ails us? Can we ingest them and feel them doing their work on our insides and come away from our reading with clearer eyes, maybe even stronger hearts? Let's hope so. Every year, the Library of Michigan puts out a list of Michigan notable books, featuring stories that are about Michigan or set in Michigan or written by Michigan authors. These lists always have such a nice zeitgeisty feel, and I couldn't help but wonder how the library committee would use their powers of curation to bring something to this unique moment in our lives and our reading lives. Tim Gleisner is manager of special collections at the Library of Michigan. He wrangles the committee that selects the titles. And Jessica Trotter is a librarian with the Capital Area District Library. She's one of the committee members. Tim, Jessica, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us, April.
So the Library of Michigan publishes this list every year. I've got to wonder how different it was doing the list this time around, given the unprecedented nature of everything people were living through in 2020 and are still living through today. Tim, was it more difficult?
Yeah. To be honest, at the beginning of the year, it was hard to see how we even move forward. But with the committee, we were able to exchange titles, exchange ideas, you know, obviously, like everyone else, go virtual on our meetings. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was definitely more chaotic this year, for sure.
Very much.
What were some of your guiding stars in trying to figure out a list of notable books that reflect what's on writers' minds and also the moment that we're in right now?
Boy, Jessica, I'll let you take that one.
Of course you will. I don't know that we had any actual discussion as a guiding force for the group. But I think as we all worked our way through the books, that important issues jumped out at us and made us kind of champion different titles for that reason.
And I think you know, the guiding principle of how best to reflect our state in all its various aspects. I mean, I think if you want to know a guiding principle for all of us, and I think it's very important for all of us, is really trying to represent as many voices as possible in 20
yes,
books.
Yes, agreed.
And it's not always so easy, but you know, that diversity of ethnicity, geography, you know, I mean, just anything that we could do to try to show the various aspects of our state. It's not always easy to do, but that is definitely, for me, and I think a lot of the people, is a guiding principle for all of us.
Yes.
Well, let's dive into it. I know, Jessica, one of your favorites also happened to be one of mine, and that is Black Bottom Saints by Alice
yes.
Randall. We recorded
yes.
a lovely interview with her this year, but do you want to say a little bit about this just to set up what the book is and its very unusual creative form?
Yeah, it's and that's kind of what jumped out at me. And I will say it's one of those things I had a harder time reading in with everything going on this year. And the thing about the Black Bottom Saints is that it's set up in the form of sort of a saints book, a book of saints. I mean, it's short. I don't want to say quite biographies, but it is sort of write-ups about different individuals in the history of Black Bottom neighborhood in Detroit. And it's something that I could approach kind of piece by piece instead of one long narrative. But it had me kind of going and, you know, running around trying to find out more about these individual characters. And that's one of the really big draws it was for me.
Tim, let's talk about one of your favorites. This was a title I wasn't as familiar with, A Star in the Sycamore. Will you tell us about it?
Oh. I mean, for me, it was just a beautiful book. It's a author, Tom Springer. It's set in his home part of the state, down in the Three Rivers area, Three Rivers, Battle Creek. And he really just talks about the nature next door. And it's a collection of really just essays that, as he's told me, he writes very slowly. And you can tell. I mean, like, this is, to me, it's just a beautiful piece of art that really just delves into the beauty of the nature of our state and just, you know, the best way I can say it is just the nature next door. And it's something that, quite frankly, I've said this often, and Jessica, you know, has heard me say this often. I just didn't want to put this book down. I didn't want it to stop. I wanted more essays. And I found it to be just a very, very, very beautiful book overall, just exploring the nature of our state.
End of last year, we lost the great nature writer Barry Lopez. I remember him saying once that all the beautiful nature writing in the world is really for nothing if you can't give the reader a really good story. Can you give us an example of some way in which Tom Springer delivers that?
I mean, concisely, no. I would say that, you know, the way he delivers it for me is the fact that he, and I don't have a specific example, so I apologize right off the top of my head, but what I would say about Springer is he really looks at just everyday things that you would just find out outside in your yard, right? And he's able to really just give it a majesty, a nobility that you wouldn't otherwise attribute to the various aspects of, say, southwestern Michigan. You know, I mean, southwestern Michigan probably isn't the subject of a lot of books, but whenever he writes about his place and his sense of place, again, it gives it a nobility that I think we sometimes, you know, quite frankly, just drive by and we don't pay any mind to. But he really is just an observer. He observes his nearby world and again, just elevates it to a point where it's just poetry, in my opinion.
Jessica, another book that you brought to talk about is the novel Half by Sharon Harrigan that came out on University of Wisconsin Press this year. It's mm-hmm. a little bit family drama. It's a story about identical twins, Paula and Artis, who are very, very closely bonded together. They speak in one voice, until at some point in their life they can't. And the story tells the story of their growing into adulthood and growing apart in many ways, and their reunion on the occasion of their dad's funeral as they start to re-examine what was a pretty traumatic childhood.
Right.
What struck you about this one?
It was a structure. It was the style. I found it. Harrigan makes the choice to, they speak in one voice for a huge chunk of the book. And she doesn't really reveal, you know, which of the twins is speaking. They are essentially one personality. And it's the unraveling of the story. I mean, because it starts with their father's funeral and it's moving both backwards and then later forwards. And it's just spun out in such a interesting way that it drew me in. There was a level of suspense to it because of the relationship with their father, and you don't quite know what separated them or separates them. It's just one that it struck a lot of us, just the style and the quirky makes it sound funny, and I don't mean it that way. It's haunting. It was just an interesting story that stuck with me.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Jessica Trotter and Tim Gleisner, part of the team that chose this year's annual list of Michigan Notable Books. You said something a little earlier that really rung in my ears, and that's that there were some books that were difficult to read this year. I've talked to so many people who say that their attention span has been really mm-hmm. challenged. There's so much mm-hmm. chaos going on, so many news stories, so many people just trying to stay off their small screens long enough to really immerse in a book.
Right.
Is there something to trying to read difficult books in a difficult time that maybe focuses the attention?
I would not be the best person to answer that because I tried to get away from them. I couldn't focus on the more difficult books. It was really only towards the end, and luckily kind of forced myself in a way for the committee, but it was really only in the fall that I've been able to really focus on some of those harder stories. I found it absolutely the reverse. I was gravitating toward much more comfort.
Such as?
Than challenging. I'm not sure if there's any example on the list.
Oh, come on. Let's bust out.
Maybe.
I need to hear.
I actually found, and actually it's the other book that I suggested, I Have Something to Tell You. That one, I can honestly say I probably didn't pay a whole lot of attention to Mayor Pete's run in some ways. I didn't particularly realize that Cheston Buttigieg was from the Michigan area, from Traverse area. But when I realized it was on the list, and I really wanted to kind of go and figure out what was going on. And it was, I don't want to say chatty because it's not quite that, but it was an easier read, but still carried a lot of, talked about a lot of important issues.
Conversational in tone, maybe.
Yes, exactly. And that one actually is one, it was kind of when I was more getting over my reading issues. And I love that as an audio. I loved hearing him read that book. And it's, you know, but it still touches on, it's not a political book per se. I mean, he's a political husband, but this is more of a him telling his story. And the thing is, his story is still guided by somebody else's political choices. His issues with school debt, medical debt, whole concept of coming out, all of these things are affected by our politics, but it wasn't a polemic, and it wasn't, you know, it was a very conversational storytelling about his life.
Tim Gleisner, what about you? Did you find yourself able to focus enough to really read and take in books at this time?
So, you know, I'm just a nerd. And so, I mean, to be honest with you, history is my escapist, right? And I know it sounds weird, but I find comfort and solace because as much as, you know, the chaos of this past year, and there has been a lot of it in many different ways, I find comfort in really reading about past experiences that in some cases could have been just as challenging and chaotic. And it gives me hope, right? That, you know, that we've gotten through similar times before. And I know that sounds very just nerdish, but I mean, for me, I really, if I can find a good history that can take me, I'm just a nonfiction guy. And so that's what I do a lot of. And so this past year, anything I could grab my hands on that just, again, just reading about past times in our country or world's history, because any history for me is a good history. It just helps because it gives me hope to know that, you know, we can get through this. We've gotten through similar, if not worse, things before.
Well, I guess that brings us to your recommendation, Miles Harvey's The King of Confidence, about King James Strang.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, think about that, right? I mean, the man tried to set up his own kingdom in Lake Michigan. And, you know, they pirated the shores of Lake Michigan. And for me, that was an important book just for the fact, first of all, I've always heard of King James Strang, but I never really read up on him all that much. And it's just a beautiful book, in my opinion, just because it not only explored the island and King James, but it also explored the whole society of that time and really just how kind of, not on the edge, but kind of how strange American society was going. I mean, Mormonism was just taking effect in upstate New York. They were getting, you know, ousted from town after town after town until some of them ended up in Utah. And then this little band ended up in Beaver Island. To me, that book was just, it really just portrayed the whole of American society. It wasn't just about King James, but it really showed all the different strands that were going into, you know, this man who basically was trying to form his own country within a country at that point. To me, it was just a brilliant book on many different levels.
I wanted to ask if either of you are in places where you manage to get outside much. It's, you know, readers are, I think people assume that readers are by definition indoor bookish, but, and that's, you know, that's definitely a thing. But I also know a lot of readers who really need to have a long walk either before or after they sit down with a book. Jessica, is that your situation?
Yeah, I found, with all of this going on, I found more trails around my apartment complex than I knew were there. So, yeah.
How about you, Tim?
The North Country Trail. I've been trying to hit as many different parts of the North Country Trail, which is a hiking trail, kind of like the Appalachian, but it takes the whole northern half of our country. But it goes, as a significant, if not the largest part of it, goes through Michigan. And so if I can get down to Marshall or to Middleville or Lowell or Newaygo, even farther afield, I definitely have been walking as much as possible. And I think that was the thing about the Springer book for me was, you know, that essentially, you know, if I had the ability to write like that man did, I mean, there was just so much that gave me solace on that trail, on all the different parts that I know he could capture. I don't know if I'm as good. But yeah, definitely walking helps a great deal.
This is a year in which politics has invaded so many parts of life, even parts that we often wish that it wouldn't. there were difficult holiday conversations, rifts within families. Are there ever any political considerations that come up in the book selection process?
That's a Tim question.
Are there political considerations?
Or political disagreements?
No. I've never seen a disagreement. I think the only thing that's disagreed upon is really the worth sometimes of a book. And I think that's the way I'm trying to say it. Maybe not the worth, but is it truly notable? right? I mean, I think the ideal and that word notable is something that we really ask ourselves. But disagreements, we disagree on titles, what should be chosen and as to why, but I've never seen politics come up once in the committee. And it's 13 people from around the state, as far afield as Detroit to Kalamazoo and everywhere in between. And to me, like, I've never seen a disagreement about that. Truly, what people like for books, yes, we disagree about that. But generally, you know, we come to an agreement by the end.
Well, there's no feud like a literary feud, so I imagine it's plenty just trying to get down to which books are the most notable.
Mm-hmm. It is, yeah.
Yeah.
Most definitely.
Those last couple meetings get interesting.
They do get interesting, but you know, it's really, I think that's, those are the best meetings, right?
They really are. Yes.
They are. They're their best meetings. I mean, we basically, we get down to what truly is important and what we feel should really be the embodiment of the state in that year when it comes to the culture of the state.
Yes. Yeah.
Tim Gleisner is manager of special collections at the Library of Michigan. Jessica Trotter's been with us, too. She's a librarian with the Capital Area District Library. Jessica, Tim, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
In a minute, we'll revisit a conversation that I had with an author of one of the books on this year's notable list, Alice Randall, author of The Black Bottom Saints. That's after a break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Alice Randall is very much at home in the city where she lives, Nashville, Tennessee. A writer in residence at Vanderbilt University, she has put her pen to hit country songs. She's done food advocacy centered on the cuisine of the Black American diaspora and has written a widely read novel set in the universe of Gone with the Wind. Looking at her CV, you might mistake her for a lifetime Southerner. But in her latest novel, Black Bottom Saints, Alice Randall lays out a feast in cinematic detail from the home of her childhood, Detroit, in the late 1960s, a Black Camelot that formed so many cornerstones of America's economic, intellectual, and artistic life. The novel is structured as a book of saints in the Catholic tradition, peopled with a range of characters that lift Black Bottom's history off the page and give voice to a place that continues to influence Detroit and the world to this day. Alice Randall, thanks for joining us. Welcome to Stateside.
April, it's wonderful to be with you.
You drop us into the story in 1967, a year when I think you yourself would have been a small kid in Detroit, right?
About 8 years old.
So our narrator, our tour guide through Black Bottom is Ziggy Johnson. He's a gossip columnist for the Black newspaper, the Michigan Chronicle, syndicated in two other cities. Alice Randall, that one detail is so loving, a gossip columnist for a Black newspaper, to think that all of those details of Black life, although small in terms of what people might consider the news events of the day, would be subject of interest and of publication. Could you tell us a little bit about the sensibility that you wanted to write with for Ziggy, who was a real person?
Well, one, Ziggy always privileged Black art aesthetics. He was a gossip columnist and an entertainment columnist, so he was steeped in Black music, Black dance, a variety of Black performances. And he was also steeped in Black language, the barbershop language of the street and the show world language. But I must note that Ziggy's language was my first language. I was born in Detroit in 1959, and the first writer I ever knew, though I, like you, would study at Harvard, but the first writer I ever knew was Ziggy Johnson. I started attending his dance school when I was 3 years old. But before I ever walked into his dance school, my father did not read to me from children's books. He read to me from newspapers. Monday through Friday, it would be the Detroit Free Press and the news. But on the weekends, it was the Michigan Chronicle. And my favorite storyteller was Ziggy.
You paint a picture of his life as an impresario at the Driftwood Lounge, booking top names in the Detroit music scene, which I guess I'm saying the top names in America at the time. And you also have him talking about the children that he taught dance to at his school, what he calls the breadwinner's children. And there's just a short passage that describes who he's talking about. Could you share that with us?
Yes, I'd love to do that. The word that explains Detroit to me, breadwinner. The partying factory people were those whom I first noticed when I arrived in the late 30s. Large numbers of Black men who earned a good, steady wage doing a skilled job, then returned to the homes they owned, ready to refuel, get dressed to the nines to head out to hear fabulous music and drink good liquor. I was the breadwinner's MC of choice and producer of choice, and proud to be so. The factory folk, the breadwinners, drove the Black city. Detroit knew this. Black Detroit knew this. We gave the factory folk who worked in the automobile plants their proper respect. We loved those men who did the shift work that meant 8 out of 10 Black families in Detroit owned the home they lived in and could afford to go out to a club to hear live music any night they chose. Our breadwinners built this city. We remember when River Rouge ran 24/7, 3 shifts a day at the plant, that the show bars had 2 shows on Sunday and late shows every night, sometimes at 2 a.m. for those who got off the late shift. That was the opportunity that created Caramel Camelot.
So this world that Ziggy Johnson lives in, this is the world of the Black Bottom Saints, and he counts among them not just famous people, but also sort of everyday folks, people like a bartender named Thomas Hayden, his own mother, who was a faithful Catholic. And there were certainly folks in his reckoning like Joe Louis, Della Reese, Billy Eckstein, and the poet Robert Hayden, and you bring them all to life. Dinah Washington and her husband, the Detroit Lions' great Night Train Lane. How did you go about selecting who Ziggy would want people to know about?
Well, there are 3 criteria to becoming a Black Bottom Saint. You have to know that I was working with, I had found about 1,000 of his columns published over 2 decades. So there were 3 criteria, and they were, 1, that they had likely been mentioned in one of Ziggy's columns, or lots of times in Ziggy's columns. 2, Ziggy had told me or the children in his dancing school about the person. And 3, they had likely walked through the lobby of the Gotham Hotel where Ziggy lived for over a decade, and which was in old Black Detroit. So, but 4, actually, they knew something significant about moving from trauma to transcendence. Because when Ziggy talked to the students in his school about his Black Bottom Saints, he was telling us the stories that would help us move from trauma to transcendence. So he was telling us the story of Black wisdom.
Right. I think some of my favorites of the saints are the people who are just sort of semi-famous. The charm school founder, Cordy Stewart, who is this really fierce mix of control and ambition with a lot of fizz. And Ada Smith, who was a celebrated singer and dancer who rubbed shoulders with James Baldwin in Paris. I don't know how you managed to choose.
I love Shirley McNeil. You know, she is going to be a Black woman, high school English teacher, but she's also going to be the person who brings transcendental meditation to the United States. That's one of the things that lets me think of myself as a blues novelist. I mean, the blues argues that no life needs to be relegated to the margins. And Ziggy, steeped in his mother's Mississippi blues background, though born in Chicago, he thought everybody was important. Long before people were talking Black Lives Matter, he was living it. And so there's space for a heroin dealer, Scatterbrain Stevens, in Ziggy's pantheon of saints, because Ziggy doesn't define people by the worst day in their life.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Alice Randall. She's the author of the new novel, Black Bottom Saints. Alice, could you talk to us about the ways that Detroit has been with you in all the places that you have gone in your life?
Absolutely. What a wonderful observation. I was born in Detroit, and I think that the chin-up swagger and the pride in just being able to outwork anybody else, but the Detroit version of that doesn't turn into John Hendry syndrome, because Detroit also privileges Black creativity and art, and not just songwriting and performing art. The Gotham Hotel was also supporting Black photographers and hosted the Shutterbug Club. So one of the things that I feel that I've had from my earliest days is a sense of art and industry that is just pure Detroit. And Detroit, even before Motown, it found one of its great flowers in Motown. But long before the Driftwood Lounge, there's going to be the Flame Show Bar. There are going to be so many clubs in Detroit. We're going to have Memphis Minnie migrating up to Detroit because it's such a great place to live. Laverne Baker, who you probably don't know, but is the second woman, not Black woman, second woman to go in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And she lives in Detroit. But who's the first woman? Aretha Franklin. She lives there too. So when I was born into Detroit in 1959, I was being born into one of the great art communities that has ever been collected in the world. We all know about Paris in the 20s, but Paris in the 20s pales compared to Detroit in the 40s.
There's a thread that runs through your prose writing that has to do with the people who get left out of history. It was certainly true of your debut novel, The Wind Ungone, that imagines this Black woman in the universe of Gone with the Wind. Her half-sister is Scarlett O'Hara. They know a lot of the same people, although Sayonara, this protagonist, walks a very different path. And we see so many people speaking to us out of the pages of history through the Black Bottom Saints. Do you feel like there are benefits and limitations to how we use fiction as a tool to fill in our historic gaps?
I think for the Black experience, that using fiction to paint some of the broad strokes and some of the nuanced strokes of the inner life of African Americans from earlier periods is essential. Because so many of my ancestors were not able to leave written reports because they could not read and write in English, that if we don't take our oral histories, if we don't privilege our oral histories and translate them into fiction, we lose them. Because there are oral histories, because there isn't documentation, I think that there's an integrity in calling it fiction, but it is a fiction that often comes closer to the truth than the actual published record because of all the things the public's record, the official accounting, cannot measure. For example, the people right now who are afraid to fill out census data because they are afraid that it could be misused by immigration officials. The published record doesn't always well and truthfully document underprivileged people.
We're in this era right now where all manner of American history is being reexamined in the same way that you have torn down some of the tropes of American history in some of your books. What do you see coming out of this time?
This is a time of reckoning. And in the time of reckoning, I think that we gain greater and greater illumination. With Black Bottom Saints, I think that one of the things that we are being called upon to celebrate is cultural wisdom that in the Black experience. For example, we have gone through just recently the Me Too movement, which I think is so important. But one of the things that was under-discussed that is we shine a light on in Black Bottom Saints is that Black women have been being raped in America since the first slave trade boats arrived and the first Black women arrived on plantations in America. And Black women and men and children have built some cultural currency and insight in how to transcend that extraordinary trauma. Not to minimize it, not to minimize that crime. We call out that crime, but we also call in the genius that the children born from those rapes, some of them created triumphant lives. And some of them know that joy is radical. Mm-hmm. And so to me, call in the Black experience, we celebrate that everyday miracle. And it reframes something significant. And I feel right now, the entire world, Black culture in America knows very a lot about rising from the ashes. The entire world needs to rise from the ashes of a global pandemic. And there is no better group of people to spot to when trying to rise from the ashes than to contemplate the Black citizens of Detroit who live there from 48 to 68.
There's a beautiful epigraph at the start of the book that discusses that. You know, in recent years, I've heard American history described alternately as a continuum on which progress moves forward and sometimes rolls back. And sometimes I've heard it described as more of a pendulum, where progress really isn't an adaptable concept. Ta-Nehisi Coates has written a little bit about this. And I wondered which read on American history rings more true to you.
I centered in my feminine interior experience. I consider myself to be a feminist. And I think that progress is not about external events. Some of it is about internal reality, because that is the one thing we can control. So I think about individual progress independent of the external political reality. But I also think that we must always think about structural obstacles to individuals achieving their interior peace and their interior happiness. The novel is divided into four sections, which are summer, fall, winter, and spring. The saints of summer are the saints of the roots of the Black experience. The saints of fall are the saints that point out that structural obstacles can be so great that an individual cannot achieve the movement from trauma to transcendence. If you are a four-year-old girl shot dead in your own house, as Tanya Blanding was in the summer of 1967, you don't get to move from trauma to transcendence, no matter how artful you are in your interior. But the saints of winter remind us that there's geniuses of Black grit, geniuses of Black movement from trauma to transcendence. But the saints of spring are my favorite. They are some of the people who have the hardest lives, who despite all, actually arrive at joy. So to me, that's the paradox, that progress is an ideal. It's not a reality.
Alice Randall's new novel is Black Bottom Saints. Alice, we didn't even get a chance to ask you about the many, many cultural moments that you drew from on this, both for the words and for an amazing list of cocktails that you concocted for each and every one of the saints so that libations can be part of their celebration. But the whole thing's a feast. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. I wanted to make a five-sense address to joy: the taste, the touch, the scent, the sound, the sight of joy. And adding all the cocktails allowed to me to do that, even in a novel that looks at public and private trauma. We get to rest on joy with the cocktails.
want to see the dance you call the black bottom. I want to learn that dance. Want to see the dance you call your big black bottom. They put you in a jam.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Bear. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time.